Hi, this is Zoe.
And this is Justina.
And this is the Empowered Healing Podcast.
Welcome back to the Empowered Healing Podcast. Today, we are going to talk more about complex trauma and defining what that is.
Yeah, it's, I think that term has gained traction.
A little
bit,
yeah.
But it's still not super well known, I would say.
No, agreed. So you've heard us talk about complex trauma and borderline personality disorder. So today, we thought it would be nice to spend some time diving into what exactly complex trauma is, what it looks like, and how to help the people in your life who may be experiencing it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, diving right in about what exactly is complex trauma?
Yeah.
How do you define it?
Yeah. CPTSD, or complex post-traumatic stress disorder, also called complex trauma lots of times, is a mental health condition that arises from repeated or prolonged interpersonal trauma. And this is especially true during formative periods like childhood. So unlike the traditional PTSD, which typically results from a single traumatic event or maybe a couple of things, CPTSD stems from chronic trauma over time and is often relational and, again, often in environments where escape feels impossible.
Yeah, and I think that is often like the defining point for me. I always make a point to mention that of you're put in a situation where you can't escape the things right. that are happening to you.
Yeah.
The things that are causing your dysregulation and the, all of the things.
Mm-hmm.
And so that could be, childhood abuse, whether it's emotional, physical, sexual, some sort of neglect or abandonment,
mm-hmm.
Usually from caretakers.
Right.
Domestic violence, mm-hmm. which can happen at any age, at any point.
Right.
Human trafficking, any sort of captivity,
mm-hmm.
Living in war zones,
mm-hmm.
Or existing under other kinds of oppressive systems.
Yeah.
And kind of going back to like the caretaking front of being raised by caretakers with untreated mental illness or addiction or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is a very long list of things. And I think, a lot of people can relate to experiencing at least one of these during childhood, unfortunately.
Oh, absolutely. I think more of us have experienced this than not to some degree.
Yeah. I don't disagree with that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So helping people understand that complex trauma is not a fault of yours, again, that it was something you could not escape. And so often that we see clients that have experienced these things in childhood and hold a belief that they could have done more.
Yeah. And that's such an important part to try to dismantle and deconstruct mm-hmm. in their minds.
Yeah.
You literally couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
You had no choice.
Mm-hmm.
Your body, your nervous system was operating in the way it needed to in order to keep you safe.
Right.
And oftentimes it comes with the consequences. When you're older in adulthood, you're still experiencing these things.
Right. So some of these symptoms of CPTSD that were things that likely kept you alive and safe at some point and were adaptive for you, when you grow up or you get into new relationships, they become maladaptive. They get in the way.
Yeah. When you're no longer in the environment mm-hmm. that you couldn't escape from.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly they're not as helpful.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They tend to cause some problems for you.
They sure do.
So when you think of like the symptomology of complex trauma, obviously you have like the typical post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms, flashbacks, mm-hmm. hypervigilance, avoidance of triggers or the things that remind you of the traumatic things.
Yeah.
But complex trauma comes with some additional layers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Things like affective dysregulation. So one of the big things that you see in BPD diagnoses, this is very common for folks with complex trauma.
Yeah.
That they experience intense mood swings, really a lot of difficulty calming down or conversely, numbing or feeling overwhelmed by their emotions.
Yeah, this is like the roller coaster experience of big highs, big lows, or just the overall numbness to it all.
Right, right. And in that numbness, there often can be, we'll get into dissociation a bit later, but some of that numbing sometimes can be mentally checking out and helping people understand that that's, you're not in control of that right now.
Yeah, that, like we mentioned at the beginning, it's part of like the response that your nervous system developed in order to keep you safe.
And once was helpful.
Yeah.
Maybe current times, not so much.
Yeah. And so another thing that people with complex trauma often experience is a negative self-concept.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, eventually we'll get into some of the neuroscience of why these things arise. But oftentimes people who experience complex trauma carry deep shame or guilt or this feeling of being broken.
Yeah.
Like it's, but that, like, that's not the case. It's, oftentimes they think that, you know, it's that they're bad, not that something bad has happened to them.
And the negative beliefs that we see and hear a lot is, I am not enough.
Yeah, I didn't do enough.
Or I am too much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tend to hear that one a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're too much. Go be in your room by yourself.
Yeah.
Until you calm down.
What a hard place to be.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Not enough and too much.
Yeah, that's a huge incongruence to try and make sense of, especially with growing up with that always being the narrative.
Absolutely. And again, like we had mentioned, like as you grow older and you're out of these spaces, I think that's one of the other things that kind of comes with complex trauma is this sense of relational difficulty that you may see people with complex trauma pull away from others or on the flip side, become overly dependent. There's a recreation of these trauma dynamics in their new relationships.
Absolutely. It becomes really difficult to trust other people because if you're experiencing these terrible conditions and you cannot escape, especially when it is your primary caregiver that is treating you in this way, it's really hard to trust other people.
It's like impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you think about the fact that these are going back to like childhood, for instance, it's supposed to be like a safe time for you. You should feel safe in that environment.
That your parents kept you safe.
But
in a secure relationship.
Yeah. But that's not the case with these people. Mm-hmm. And that safety was not a given.
Right.
So why would we trust people
mm-hmm.
when it could compromise what we perceive as keeping us safe?
Yeah. Well, I want to relate back to that. Negative self-concept and disturbances in relationships are also in the diagnostic criteria for borderline personality disorder.
Yeah.
So these very common experiences with CPTSD are treated as symptoms of a personality disorder.
Yeah. Again, which amplifies the negative self-concept.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, I actually am really broken. I have this personality disorder. It's just
it's
who I am.
It's built in. I can't change it
mm-hmm.
because, again, not a lot of people have a solid understanding of personality disorders. And I think especially with borderline, people have the assumption that it is a fixed part of who they are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They just have to learn to deal with it of, okay, I'm always going to have these issues.
Right, right. It's not true.
Not true at all.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about how complex trauma affects the brain.
This is my favorite.
Yeah.
I'm like so passionate about this because I really do think it helps not only reduce some of the shame,
mm-hmm.
but like it validates the experience of, oh wait, there are so many parts of my brain that have been impacted as a result of what I went through. Maybe I'm not actually the issue. Maybe it's what happened to me.
Right. It's not that I'm broken.
Yeah. So I think the first one, a pretty easy one, is the amygdala. Think of it as like our brain's alarm system, our smoke detector. In someone with complex trauma whose alarm system has gone off time and time and time again, it's learned to become extra sensitive of it's constantly on the lookout for those sources of potential threat. Even if there aren't actual threats, that system is on alert. It is looking for anything that could be a danger to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you are experiencing constant unrest or not being sure what to expect day to day or even sometimes hour to hour, of course your brain becomes on high alert. It wants to keep you safe.
Yeah. And so that's why a lot of people with complex trauma can't ever truly feel relaxed, because when your alarm system is activated, things like hypervigilance, you know, panic, a constant sense of being on edge just are par for the course when that detector, that smoke alarm, whatever you want to call it, is going off all the time.
Yeah, this is a really difficult piece to help people actually feel like they can rest.
Yeah, of how, and to totally validate a person's experience of, it makes total sense why you feel uneasy all the time. If you were sitting in a house and the smoke detector was going off the whole day, all day, every day, for days on end, I probably wouldn't be too restful either. It's exhausting. It's overwhelming.
It's so much.
Yeah. And so part of work with complex trauma is learning how to reduce that response or to check in with it of, okay, I hear the alarm going off. Is there an actual threat? Am I safe?
Yeah.
Do I need to operate and act on something?
Right.
Or can I trust that I'm safe in the moment?
Yeah. And having to relearn all of those things because you weren't able to.
Yeah. Bunch of relearning when it comes to complex trauma, because it, you know, compared to like the typical PTSD, where it's like maybe one big event or a couple of big things kind of in quick succession of each other. Complex trauma is a bunch of things that happened over, it could be a, you know, a little bit of time, a long period of time.
First 18 years of life sometimes. Yeah, it's chronic.
Yeah. And so it takes time to unravel that of, you experienced it for 18 years. Don't take a minute to undo 18 years worth of damage.
Absolutely. And the beautiful part of the brain is that you can.
Yes.
It takes a lot of work and it is not easy, but you can.
Yes. And we'll talk about neuroplasticity a little bit later.
Let's move on to the hippocampus, the piece that is involved in memory and in contextualizing experiences, of making sense of events.
Yeah, a lot of times the metaphor or the imagery I give for clients with the hippocampus is that it works as like the timestamp. So our memories are files on a desk, and our hippocampus is responsible for timestamping them and putting them away in the memories. So we can, you know, if you think about a positive memory that happened in the past, you're usually able to say, oh, this happened however long ago in the past, and experience it in that way. But with a traumatic memory, whether it's complex trauma or not, that part of our brain goes offline. And so it's not able to accurately timestamp. And so it's left open. And so this memory was never put on a shelf in a file somewhere else. And so when it is brought up, whether through a trigger, whether through some other thing, that person is quite literally experiencing it as if it's happening.
And that can be so many things. And even if the situation is just similar to something that you experienced in the past, your brain cannot tell the difference between what was happening then and what is happening right now. And that's when that hypervigilant smoke alarm goes off.
Yeah, and that's where I think I see, at least with my clients, some frustration that pops up, especially with complex trauma, because they have triggers they're not even aware of. And so then suddenly they're having this big reaction and they get frustrated themselves. They don't know why it's happening. It's confusing and scary. And it feels pretty defeating of, I feel this thing and it's intense.
And I have no idea what's going on.
I have no clue what's going on. So I don't know how to do anything about
it. If I don't know what's going on, how can I even fix that?
Yeah.
So slowing down, identifying triggers, relearning safety.
So important. So integral to the work with complex trauma.
Yeah. And the file folders, like you were talking about in the hippocampus, where you're kind of sorting things into where they belong. This is also why a lot of times we have folks with complex trauma who say they can't remember their childhood.
Yeah.
Because those memories aren't in file folders. They're just scattered all over the place.
Yeah.
And sometimes we can re-access them and sometimes not.
Yeah. And I always get curious about a client, because a lot of times I do have clients who like want to be able to recover those memories, and totally valid. It's a part of your life. I think even the worst part, some of us want to be able to recall the things that have happened to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important of setting that expectation up front of we can try. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's no guarantee that these memories will ever resurface because of the way our brains work and the way that that survival mechanism is in place.
Oh, yeah. Those are real strong walls.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is, I use that same metaphor with EMDR with folks that sometimes that can help find some of those memories and put them kind of in the correct file folder so that that smoke alarm does not go off quite as often.
Yeah.
Which is really cool.
It
Another
is.
Episode talk about interventions, but that
is
an analogy that I use a lot
so
too,
cool.
Those file folders.
Yeah. And so another small thing with the hippocampus is not only the difficulty differentiating like current events and things in your environment from like past things that have happened, but like flashbacks and intrusive memories.
Yeah.
This also kind of comes from the hippocampus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those things that are just those files that are left open that can just pop up at any given time.
Yep. Like, cool. Great. Love that for me.
Yep. And lots of people I've heard, I thought I was over this, but I guess I'm not.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, it takes time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. And we can always continue learning.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on to the prefrontal cortex,
Ooh.
That logical piece.
Yeah. One of the last parts of the brain to fully develop. You know, it's responsible for all of the higher order functions.
Mm-hmm.
That's our executive functioning network. I like to call it like the CEO of the brain.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
The one that's getting shit done.
Yep.
It handles logic, decision-making, emotional regulation, impulse control. It's like the big guns when it comes to like top-down stuff of like, how do we effectively navigate our days? And so trauma makes this part harder to access. Like sometimes it just shuts off.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, like it makes sense in a survival situation or what your brain perceives as a survival situation. It's not important to weigh the pros and cons of any given situation. It's I need to act or else I might die.
I need to fight this. I need to get the hell out of here, or I need to freeze and make sure that nothing else happens here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so after a traumatic experience has happened, or in the case of complex trauma, where you're away from that. And so you have some baseline of safety logically in that sense of, okay, I know I'm not there anymore.
Yeah.
But I'm still having these reactions.
Yes.
And so that disconnect becomes very apparent of, okay, you're not in that environment anymore. And yet you're still experiencing all the things you did.
Right.
If you can't outthink it.
Right.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. And this is where I also see a lot of clients that say they know these things to be true. I know that I am safe. I know that I can trust this person. I know that this isn't going to happen, but my body doesn't believe it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's such a, I feel like, frustrating point for clients. And oftentimes we get stuck here for a while of, yeah, you absolutely, like, I'm sure you do know it logically. Like, we can see the order of events. It's clear.
Yep.
And yet that disconnect is so apparent that your nervous system hasn't caught on yet.
Yeah.
It hasn't updated in a way that makes you feel safer in those situations, genuinely safer.
Yeah.
Because there's a difference between, like, logically understanding and actually experiencing safety.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this, when we're thinking about amygdala, hippocampus, and prefrontal cortex, there's a lot of disconnect sometimes between the brain and the body where you can know something to be true, but you don't feel it. And that's that disconnect in the hippocampus. So if we work through memories with lots of different treatments, it helps turn everything on to work as one because it doesn't do that right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And on that idea of like feeling disconnected from things kind of jumps into another part of the brain that plays a role in complex trauma. And that's the default mode network. This part of your brain is active when you're idle, when you're daydreaming, when you're thinking about like yourself. So like self-reflection and like self-concept. Heavily involved in this.
Yeah, this is where we find what people sometimes describe as the ego.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not Freud ego, but the ego of this
like,
is who I am.
I'm aware of who I am. Like, here's my consciousness.
Right.
And trauma obviously can disrupt the system as it as we're aware of now. it impacts so many parts of the brain. Not surprisingly, that impacts us too.
Right.
And so part of like that negative self-concept comes from here.
Yep.
The harsh inner narratives you hear of, I'm broken, it was my fault, I could have done more.
Mm-hmm.
A fragmented self sense of self in general of, I don't know who I am outside of these experiences. I've been on fight or flight forever. I don't know what it's like to not be.
Yeah. And feeling that disconnection from yourself, having that identity confusion or a sense of not being a real person, all also encompass experiences of dissociation.
Yeah. So just yet another level of like disconnect between mind and body.
The brain, it does incredible things, but ultimately it is a dumb supercomputer that it picks up on patterns and it believes them to be true.
Yeah. Yeah. Of it has some useful features and
really
at what cost? Like like these things develop, but then they don't update on their own. There's not like, it's like, okay, that trauma has come and gone.
Yeah, this default mode network just keeps running like, on what it knows already. It's not taking in new information without intentionally doing that and challenging that.
Yeah.
And I'll, again, talk about interventions later, but this is why psychedelic therapy is thought to work really well, because it disrupts this default mode network in a way that most other things cannot.
Yeah.
Which is really cool.
Yeah. I was reading just before this episode an article that was kind of mentioning like the use of psilocybin and like its impact on the default mode network. So cool.
It is so cool.
And like the research that it like open, it like increases the trait of like openness in people to like try new things, to be more open to things.
Yep.
So interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. No, I'm not going to go on that a ton. Episode 3 of this series, we'll talk about interventions, and I plan to spend a whole lot of time talking about.
We're gonna reel it back into the final part of the brain, the neuroscience that we want to talk about today, and that's the attachment system and our nervous system. So, if we look at it, the nervous system in general, during complex trauma, the nervous system gets rewired to anticipate threat and expect it. That is the normal. So people living, they live in chronic fight, flight, freeze, shutdown, and have difficulty accessing connected states. And I'm going to bring in a little bit of polyvagal jargon to explain and conceptualize the nervous system. So like in a nutshell, there's like three areas on like a ladder that your nervous system can be a part of. There's the top, which is like the calm, safe, connected. I feel no threat. I'm at peace. The world feels doable. I feel resilient. There's the middle, which is like a yellow space. It's the fight or flight. You know, we all kind of have an understanding of what fight or flight looks like. It's that activation, the dysregulation. I've got to do something in this situation. And then there's the lowest part, which is shutdown. So fight or flight isn't working. And a lot of times in complex trauma, we're in that state a lot and nothing's happening. And so there's this third option of shutdown, withdraw, dissociate, numb, of it's safe. In a sense, think of like a possum playing dead. Of that's my last resort.
A great example. And this is where we see people isolate a lot.
Yeah. And in complex trauma, they jump between the fight or flight and the shutdown so often that oftentimes it might feel like somebody's like knocked a couple of rungs off of the ladder, and that safety and connection, you just can't reach it. It's too far away.
Yeah. And the best way in this analogy to help heal and move up the proverbial ladder is to build that safety and connection that we heal in relationships.
Yeah.
Which are the things that feel the hardest.
Yeah. And I always make such a point to like recognize that and like validate the fear of that, but also that like that is the way forward, is experiential growth and experiential learning. So the way our nervous systems build that sense of safety and build the evidence that, okay, like I can be in this space without having to go to an extreme.
Well, we're on the topic of relational, we'll hop back to attachment in the brain. So that early relational trauma affects attachment system, right? Those are wired through a couple of different ways. So oxytocin is the bonding hormone. Mm-hmm. This is disrupted a lot, making it harder to feel safe with others. So oxytocin comes in waves when you are feeling bonded, when you are holding someone. Mm-hmm. So if a child is experiencing neglect, they chronically have low levels of oxytocin. Yeah. So their brain does not know how to create it and utilize it effectively.
Yeah.
Then you have the whole mirror neuron system. This becomes impaired, and that can limit empathy. It can limit attunement to others and co-regulation, that it becomes really hard to feel safe in a relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the mirror neurons are essentially like the parts of the brain that help you respond to like another person. Mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. If another person's crying, for instance, you might feel compelled to to shed a tear.
Yeah.
Like it helps build that empathy or how to respond in those situations.
And this is how babies and little kids learn how to respond. So watching how the adults or other children in a room respond to other people and respond to you, you learn those responses by watching.
Yeah. It's, you know, the cliche that like your kids pick up on everything. It's not a cliche.
Sure do. They do. They actually do.
A very normal part of our development. And if all they're picking up on are these things, no wonder people with complex trauma have a really difficult time with relationships of any kind.
Right.
Whether it's friends, whether it's a romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. It wasn't modeled for them. Right. They weren't able to pick up on it accurately.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. It's all tough.
Yeah.
So a lot of those attachment and mirror neuron, oxytocin type things that are involved with learning how to be a person when you're a little kid, when you don't have those things, that can contribute a lot to more dissociation. Or again, like you said, reading those social cues, that it's really difficult because you didn't learn.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's another point of helping people be gentle with themselves when they're really hard on themselves, making friends or being in relation with others.
Yeah. Again, it's something that you have to learn. Mm-hmm. And to all these things, they're all learning experiences.
Yeah.
But the good thing is it's possible. Yes. Our brains are plastic. They're mm-hmm. malleable. Mm-hmm. And that's where neuroplasticity comes in. And oftentimes, the way I like describing neuroplasticity to clients is the idea that like your brain is a park and your current neural networks are the sidewalks. So the ways the complex trauma has impacted you, the ways you so automatically, you know, whether it's the emotional direct dysregulation, whether it's you pull away from things, whatever your specific coping responses are to the trauma are your sidewalks. They're concrete. They're the immediate step you take without thinking.
Mm-hmm. It's the automatic. Yep.
Yeah. You're like, these are the sidewalks.
Mm-hmm.
So what neuroplasticity is deciding to walk through the grass. Mm-hmm. There's no clear cut path. It might take effort to like build a path there.
Yeah. But with sometimes trudging through the jungle.
Yeah. Because we don't know what's out there. There's a lot of uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
Both time and reinforcement. Those paths start becoming apparent. And so desire paths are made, those dirt paths that you see through grass. And the hope is with time, those become reinforced enough that maybe your brain defaults to that. Or maybe it's a little easier to choose that over the sidewalk.
And unfortunately, this is not an easy thing. And it's not something that happens with a couple of therapy sessions. It can be lifelong learning. And that sounds negative. It sounds like a detractor from really wanting to do it. But all of us are lifelong learning anyway.
Yeah.
But if we're not challenging that default mode, the path that we usually take, we're just going to keep always going there.
Yeah, absolutely. And oftentimes, again, I think this is something that comes up a lot with trauma work, is eventually you hit a point where a client's getting frustrated, or you know, I'm not seeing progress that I want to see or whatever, being able to validate that and come back to this point. Mm-hmm. That neuroplasticity takes time. Rewiring your brain takes time and takes consistency.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be willing to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay if sometimes you need a pause. you don't need to push forward forever. That's exhausting too.
Absolutely. And also life happens. So even in the best of circumstances that you're like, oh, I've been doing all this work, I feel really great. And then life happens and you're knocked back to that default mode.
Yeah.
And it can feel really disheartening.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Being able to sit with a client during that, I can imagine how defeating this must feel.
Right.
That like you've gone back to the sidewalk in mm-hmm. this situation. Mm-hmm. And that sidewalk has been built oftentimes for a lifetime.
Right.
That, of course, in times of stress.
Your brain wants it to be easy.
Yeah.
It does not want to have to do extra
work. Automatic. Mm-hmm. And if that's still the stronger association, yeah, makes sense that we fall back to it. Mm-hmm. Even if we don't want to.
Right.
It's our brain's work.
Mm-hmm. Especially when it's relational. Say you have complex trauma from your primary caregivers, mom, dad, whatever. And then something happens that is traumatic with them later in life. Mm-hmm. That's where we see this happen a lot.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
But you can feel better.
You can. It's possible. And with neuroplasticity, it's that ability to rewire is possible with safe relationships, with intentional regulation techniques and targeted therapies. There are a ton of therapies nowadays that are coming out that are gaining popularity mm-hmm. that work with mind, body, and relationship.
Yeah, that we're seeing really great results with.
Yeah, like both top down and bottom up.
Yeah.
Combined into one.
Yeah. So that talk therapy from the top, from that prefrontal cortex where we're cognitively challenging things, and also from that bottom-up perspective of, all right, we're also feeling it in our bodies here.
Yeah. And being able to really integrate the two because mm-hmm. of the disconnect that you often see in complex trauma.
Right.
It's so important that you're able to merge the gap and
bring
them both together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So a personal favorite of mine is using IFS or parts work of any kind, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Of it. It allows you to experience what you're feeling, but mm-hmm. in a way that feels slightly safer. You mm-hmm. put it into parts instead of a core part of who you are.
Yeah.
And that ability to unblend from those parts reduces shame.
Yeah.
Of, I'm not all the things that have happened. I'm not all the parts that I'm carrying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm myself.
Right.
And I have all these parts that have been put in place to protect me.
Yeah.
That are maybe working in extreme roles right now,
mm-hmm.
but don't have to be. Can we get curious about them? Can we offer them what they need?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. They become very automatic to try and keep you safe.
Yeah. No. Mm-hmm. So, the exploration of that,
yeah.
which that can take a long time.
Right. Right.
No. None of these are quick and easy fixes.
No, unfortunately not. Then we have EMDR, which I am, of course, very passionate about. And I mentioned a little bit about it earlier, but it really does help bridge those cognitive thoughts and the feelings in the body. And this is, I feel like it's difficult to sum the therapy up.
Yeah.
But the best way to say it really is that it does, is that we have you re-experience the past just a tiny bit. This tiny bit of recall in your body. So I tell people it's like dipping your toe in the past while you are very grounded and safe in the present. So there's a ton of work that happens before any of the processing of anything traumatic comes up, that we build a whole lot of resources to make sure you feel safe first.
Absolutely.
And if your EMDR therapist is not doing this with you, please run.
Yeah, don't do that. You don't want to re-traumatize yourself.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that goes for any sort of trauma treatment in general.
Sure.
If you don't have that safe and stable base where you know you can ground yourself, you have techniques, you feel confident in your ability to be able to bring yourself back down.
It's not going to work.
It's not going to work. It might do more harm.
Yeah.
But all that to say, those are a couple.
Mm-hmm.
There's also somatic therapy, which is like very body focused, obviously, given the name.
Yeah.
And psychedelic assisted therapy, which we talked about a little bit, and we'll talk about more in our treatment episode.
Yeah.
But
there's a lot to say about it.
There is. At the end of the day, all of these sort of therapies that bridge that gap help reintegrate traumatic memories. They rebuild neural pathways for safety and connection instead of like threat.
Yep.
And they reconnect the prefrontal cortex with our emotional brain.
Yep.
And so you see that integration.
Mm-hmm.
You're able to experience it without that disconnect.
Yeah. And it's instead of having an automatic trigger that it gives you more space to slow down and react, which is so cool to see.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because when it is triggered, like that threat system is triggered, it's so automatic.
Mm-hmm.
It's so quick. I mean, we can't even perceive how fast it is.
Right.
So to even have just a little bit of time to be able to recognize it.
Right.
Makes the world a difference.
And revolutionary, like truly, truly for people to be able to have that little bit of time.
Yeah.
That time between the stimulus and response that for people who have experienced trauma, especially complex trauma, it is very, very, very small window. But being able to open that window and widen it up helps so much.
Yeah. There's a lot of power there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're going to go back on the tangent here about borderline personality disorder in the next section. But with complex trauma, it is not a current diagnosis in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately. So it is very common with our current diagnostic criteria for it to be misdiagnosed, especially because it shares symptoms with several other mental health conditions.
Yeah.
And because complex trauma is often under-recognized, especially in adults.
Yeah.
So lots of clinicians might treat the symptoms without actually identifying the trauma as the root cause.
Yeah. And we'll talk a little bit about, you know, the things that prevent complex trauma from really being a diagnosis,
mm-hmm.
especially like in our country. But regardless of that, some of the things that it is similar to and overlaps with, I think number one, borderline personality disorder.
The one we see the most often when it's typically complex trauma, especially if it is a woman, like we've talked about before, it is usually more of a knee-jerk reaction to diagnose borderline personality disorder here.
Yeah. And, you know, I get that, like the constellation of mm-hmm. symptoms look so similar. Like it was a Venn diagram. There's a lot of overlap.
Almost all of it.
A lot of overlap. But that the reasons why you're experiencing those symptoms are radically different in both of these situations.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. So we mentioned some of the similar symptoms earlier, but things like the emotional dysregulation. It makes sense that if you've experienced complex trauma, it's difficult to regulate emotions. Having fear of abandonment. If you didn't have a caregiver that was safe and somebody that was constantly coming and going, of course you're afraid that someone's going to leave.
Yeah, why wouldn't you be?
Yeah, if things felt shaky, uncertain, you didn't know what to expect, of course you're terrified of abandonment.
Yeah.
And right along with that, unstable relationships. That it, if anything that you take away from this episode with complex trauma is that complex trauma directly relates in difficulty in relationships.
Oh, 100%.
Because severs our ability to connect with other people.
Yeah, because a lot of times if you look at some of the causes that we talked about for complex trauma, most of those are in some way, shape, or form tied to relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes total sense why it would continue to impact relationships, because that's where it was rooted.
Yeah, yeah. And then self-harm or suicidal ideation. People who have experienced complex trauma experience a lot of self-harm and suicidal ideation, that if you believe you are chronically unworthy, a lot of folks don't want to be here. They don't want to continue to experience this. So suicidal ideation and self-harm are very common with complex trauma.
Yeah, except a lot of times in our field,
mm-hmm.
you'll see these cluster symptoms and immediately go the borderline
personality disorder.
This person has not great relationships.
Mm-hmm.
There's a history of self-harm or suicidal ideation.
Mm-hmm.
Their emotions are all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to slap the BPD label on and call it a day.
Right. Move along.
Move along. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's not helpful.
Mm-mm. So the big key difference here is that complex trauma symptoms often emerge after an identifiable trauma and tend to respond really well to trauma-informed care or those trauma treatments that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas borderline personality disorder, if it is an accurate diagnosis for someone, is considered a personality disorder and involves more pervasive identity issues and are not always rooted in trauma.
Yeah, which is why I think overwhelmingly a borderline diagnosis is actually complex trauma in disguise. Mm-hmm. It's some sort of attachment disorder, yeah. Some sort of affective mm-hmm. thing in disguise.
Right. It's usually trauma.
Yeah, because you can point it back to those past relationships or the past things that you've experienced.
Right.
Like we talked about earlier, our clients know what's happened to them. They yeah. know the things. They know why they're here. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's just some mysterious.
Yeah, it's not a surprise.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I often see a lot of people, when you're talking about that, minimizing, I could have had it worse.
Yes.
My parents weren't around a lot, but it could have been worse. They didn't physically abuse me.
Yeah. Like, that's not helpful. Mm-hmm. It's not a helpful narrative.
Yeah, the comparison is not.
Yeah. Because you still went through things. Mm-hmm. Your body acted in a certain way based on what you went through.
Your brain and body did not get what it needed to develop.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, tangent. Sorry. Yeah. Going back. other common misdiagnosis, bipolar disorder.
Yeah. So with complex trauma, sometimes you can see the mood swings and the emotional mm-hmm. dysregulation, intense emotional reactions, like we talked about earlier, that roller coaster
right.
of emotional experiences mm-hmm. And impulsive behavior, mm-hmm. which a lot of times you see in like hypomanic or manic episodes.
Right.
So a key difference is in bipolar, the mood shifts are more biologically driven and they tend to be cyclical. Like you can mm-hmm. anticipate
right.
whether it's bipolar one or two, there's mm-hmm. generally a pattern. Mm-hmm. There's a mm-hmm. rhythm that it yeah. goes with.
Mm-hmm.
Not the same with complex trauma.
Yeah, it's seemingly random.
Yeah, you have triggers in your environment that maybe you're not even aware of. Mm-hmm. So maybe you had a great week and you weren't surrounded by triggers. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm fine. Mm-hmm. Maybe the next week isn't the same. Yeah. Or like you're prompted every single day mm-hmm. to experience these things.
Yeah, if you're experiencing some type of relational stress, just like we said, a lot of this is built in relationships. So mm-hmm. a friend is mad at you. Your partner broke up with you.
Yeah.
Those things cause extreme dysregulation for folks who have experienced complex trauma.
Yeah. Sometimes I can feel like the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not an exaggeration.
It's not an exaggeration. Like it is so important to validate that.
Yeah. Because you hear clients do it all the time. Uh-huh. They say that and they're like, I'm being dramatic. I'm like,
yeah.
You're not.
Your literally body and your brain really believe that now. So let's just sit with that for a second.
Yeah. Of like, what does it mean to you mm-hmm. to like, with that understanding that mm-hmm. your brain literally doesn't know how to distinguish that. Mm-hmm. That it literally feels like a life or death thing mm-hmm. that your friend is mad at you.
Yep. Yep. It is not dramatic.
Yeah.
Mm. That's also a common negative core belief that we hear with complex trauma. Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Well,
yep.
Another diagnosis that tends to be misdiagnosed when it comes to complex trauma is ADHD.
Mm-hmm. And we see this one in men and boys, yeah. cis men and boys, the most often that they yeah. are diagnosed with ADHD
yeah.
instead of recognizing the trauma.
Yeah. And like, if you think about ADHD as like a neurodevelopmental disorder,
mm-hmm.
it makes sense that there are similarities
yeah.
because complex trauma wildly impacts your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so difficulty focusing, restlessness, forgetfulness, executive functioning issues. We mm-hmm. talked about earlier that prefrontal cortex, the CEO goes offline sometimes.
Yep.
So they probably look similar.
Yep.
But trauma-related attention issues tend to fluctuate a little more, especially with emotional states or a perceived sense of safety.
Mm-hmm.
While ADHD is more consistent across the board. It
tends to just always be there.
Yeah, it's the biology you were born with
mm-hmm.
versus something your brain learned.
Yeah. And this can usually be sussed out, like some of the other ones we said, with receiving trauma treatment. Are you getting better? Are these symptoms getting better?
Yeah. Yeah. And yep. if not, maybe worth considering.
Maybe. An alternative diagnosis.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or both.
Yeah.
Another one yes. that we, leading right into a thing that we see happen very often that they co-occur as major depressive disorder.
Yeah, I was about to say that even with several of these, like maybe you see some overlap, but oftentimes there's some level of comorbidity with complex trauma, whether it's anxiety or depression, or oftentimes it comes with stuff.
Yeah.
And so in the case of major depression, kind of the general thing is people feel hopeless. They feel numb and exhausted. They feel worthless. So a lot of things that overlap with complex trauma, you also see in depression.
Yeah.
But when they're not comorbid, when there's a difference between the two, depression in complex trauma is usually situational and linked back to the trauma that that person experienced, with things like emotional blunting interwoven in your survival responses and your adaptations, whether that's hypervigilance, dissociation, you name it.
Yeah. Yep. Now, good old isolation plays out for both here too.
Yeah.
Yep. You mentioned anxiety disorders. So complex trauma involves chronic anxiety, panic attacks, and social avoidance. Like we talked about, that amygdala, that smoke detector is
always on
all the time. So your body feels dysregulated and on all the time. So you're feeling some level of anxiety almost always sometimes.
Yeah. Because that's just how you exist in a house where a smoke alarm is going off at all points. But the key difference is the anxiety in complex trauma is rooted in that relational piece, the relational trauma and distrust and safety in general. So it's not just like a generalized fear, whether it's like a social fear or what you see in like generalized anxiety disorder, where it's just kind of all around.
Right.
Of you can link it back to something.
And sometimes clients are unaware of that. So that's work to be done too, of helping understand their anxiety and remaining curious about it.
Yeah. Curiosity is such a huge part in trauma work. I think work in therapy in general.
Agreed.
But I think especially in trauma work.
Yeah, absolutely. Always keeping an open mind.
So there's also dissociative disorders, which again, based on what we've talked about with how dissociation can pop up in somebody with complex trauma, makes sense that there's also a misdiagnosis here.
Right.
Complex trauma can involve dissociation, depersonalization, gaps in memory.
These are comorbid a lot.
Yes.
But often, again, the dissociative disorder is diagnosed, but not the complex trauma. So they're treating the symptom and not the root cause.
Yeah. Which is putting a Band-Aid over a bleeding artery. That's not going to fix things in the long term.
Nope.
So sometimes if the dissociation is very severe and includes things like identity fragmenting, it may meet the criteria for like a more severe disorder, like dissociative identity disorder, or like what people might know as multiple personality.
Yeah.
But this can often be misapplied or missed.
Yeah. Dissociation is very easily missed because it's not typically obvious unless people do have those fragmented identities. And it's very clear that, okay, this is not the same person that I was just talking to.
Yeah. Of dissociation tends to be a little more nuanced. And so, like you said,
nuanced.
If it's not so apparent and obvious, oftentimes it can go under the radar.
Yeah.
Of sometimes it's a person, maybe their eyes look far away for a second and then they're back. But sometimes you don't even recognize that if that person's out in a public space with you. Maybe it's a friend group. And chances are you might not catch it. That person might not even be aware that they did it.
Yep.
But they stepped back in their own brain for a second and then reengaged.
Yeah. We could talk about dissociation forever, but my favorite resource to understand dissociation from a client and clinician perspective is the book Dissociation Made Simple by Dr. Jamie Marich. They have parts themselves and they talk about their own experience and talk to other clinicians about their experiences. And it is a incredible perspective to see it from all different sides. So highly recommend.
That sounds powerful.
Yeah. It's a really cool book.
Yeah. We love resources on this
show. We love resources.
Yeah. There's also going back to a list, as you see, it's becoming a pretty big list of misdiagnoses.
Yeah.
Another one is with substance use, that substance use can be the primary and that maybe the complex trauma is missed.
Right.
Because people with complex trauma might be using substances to self-medicate. To manage their hyperarousal or hyperreactivity, to manage sleep disturbances. Because, you know, think about just trauma symptoms in general, whether it's sleeping too much, sleeping too little, nightmares, night terrors, the whole list of sleep disturbances that can happen with trauma.
Numb this pain.
Yeah, like numbing the pain, whether it's flashbacks or emotional pain, you name it. The addiction when it comes to like substances or like a substance use disorder diagnosis is complex trauma. This is a coping strategy.
Right.
Not the sole thing. It's not the root issue.
Yeah.
It's coping.
Right.
If I'm experiencing all these things, I don't know what to do to help me.
Right.
The self-medicating is helping me.
And substance use disorders are so multifaceted that we know that there is a genetic component, but also complex trauma also has, it looks like it is a genetic component, but it is learned behavior being passed down through families.
Yeah.
So these two things are interwoven together. And also if somebody grows up with substance use in the home, it's often really normalized, especially alcohol.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. If that's what you see your parents doing, that's how they relax or what they rely on. It makes sense to why you might have a tendency toward or predisposition to use.
And there's such a cultural component to this as well.
Is even thinking about where we live, there's like a brewery on every block.
Truly.
And like it's so normal. Drinking culture is so normalized in our country. And we could talk about that.
That can be a whole series.
But that idea that like that adds to it as well. That like it's normalized. And
yeah, it's everywhere you look.
You drinking to self-soothe or to medicate might go under the radar because of how normalized it is for whatever reason.
Yeah. I actually have a whole episode on that in my previous podcast, Balance Brains and Beauty, where I talk about motherhood and substance use disorder and how it is normalized for moms to say, all right, I'm going to go have a glass of wine or a couple glasses of wine after the kids go to sleep.
Yeah.
And how often and how easy that can lead to an alcohol use disorder.
Yeah.
When that is your coping.
Yeah.
It and turns into more.
Yeah. Because
very easily.
Kids don't necessarily get easier if you're using it
to
cope with the stress of having children or for being a mother.
Yeah.
That stress is not going away anywhere.
No, no, not at all. And I'm not trying to minimize any of this by saying the alcohol is used as coping. Parenting is freaking hard, especially when we don't have community and we are left alone and trying to wing it and figure it out. It is incredibly stressful.
Yeah.
And if it is a cultural, social norm to have drinks at the end of the day to calm down, then that's your go-to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. But is that feeling helpful ultimately?
Yeah. And I think in general with substance use, just a little side note for anyone, is so often substance use disorders are comorbid to something. Yes. Just assume it.
Yeah.
That there's probably something else attached to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. More often than not, we see the substance use disorder is based on experiencing some sort of trauma, whether that's complex trauma or not.
Yeah.
That there is a, like you said, it is a coping mechanism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it starts as, again, like lots of maladaptive coping mechanisms do, that it starts off as adaptive.
Mm-hmm.
That, okay, we're doing this a little bit every once in a while.
It makes me feel good.
I have it under control. It feels good. I don't have to think about the thing. I don't have to feel the thing.
Yeah.
And it can quickly, our brains are, again, big, dumb supercomputers that they feel good and calm.
Yeah.
It wants more of that.
Yeah, absolutely. You're like, that's making me feel good. Do more of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Continue.
More, please.
But then tolerance builds and blah, blah, blah. And then you get to a point where it's a full-out disorder.
Yeah. Suddenly things feel out of control.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
Obviously, there are a lot of things that overlap with the symptoms of complex trauma.
Yeah.
And misdiagnosis is pretty prevalent.
It is.
I think there are some reasons for that.
For sure.
I think first, if you think about how clinicians in general are trained, it's usually based on like the DSM. So mm-hmm. here are all the, you know, the categories of disorders. Here's the traits.
Here's the list. This is cut and dry. Yep. This is the diagnosis.
Check the box, whatever. That's not super trauma-informed. And it's not always very developmental. It's not, doesn't focus on that.
No.
It's very medical of, okay, here's mm-hmm. the thing, here's the symptoms, check the box, move on.
Yeah. And with those DSM diagnoses, it's usually considering what's happening right now only.
Yeah. It doesn't contextualize.
Right.
Which is like kind of important for trauma.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
it happens over a wide variety of contexts.
And is exceptionally important for us as mental health practitioners to understand the nuance of the person in front of us, that they're not just a snapshot of right now.
Yeah. There's a whole life history
mm-hmm.
in
mm-hmm.
front of you.
Yep. Yeah. And all of that led to where they are now.
Yeah. I think also our reason for misdiagnosis is that complex trauma isn't even a diagnosis in our DSM right now. There's some progress on the bigger front, the ICD. Mm-hmm. does have it as an official diagnosis.
Yeah, most of the rest of the world has this diagnosis.
Funny how our country always seems to want to be unique in that regard.
Huh. Why? Why do we have to be
just jump,
unique in this regard?
Jump well,
we
on
could
board.
Probably go down, again, a tangential thing about why that might be. But
yeah,
in this particular instance, not helpful. So...
yeah.
Just knowing that it is not an official diagnosis in the current DSM-5-TR, which is the current version of the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual. Or, yeah.
Yes.
The, yeah, everyone else, most everyone else recognizes it in the rest of the world. And lots of the symptoms can appear really chaotic and sometimes contradictory.
Yeah.
Like we said, sometimes you can feel numb and sometimes that you can be hyper aroused and seem like your mm-hmm. brain is overactive.
Yeah.
And that also can lead to fragmented or superficial labeling.
Yes. And yeah, exactly. I think we tend to take a more simplistic route sometimes because it's what's efficient, especially mm-hmm. in our medical model
mm-hmm.
of, okay, this is a snapshot of what's currently happening.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what we're going to go with based on the current thing. But
yeah.
if you have symptoms that kind of swing between extremes, or maybe it's on 1 second, off 1 second, or maybe the snapshot of this person looks different
mm-hmm.
the next day,
mm-hmm.
like different symptoms seemingly.
Yeah.
It makes sense as to why misdiagnosis might happen.
For sure. For
based
sure.
on how we operate when we diagnose.
Yeah. Agreed. So there are lots of things that help correct misdiagnosis.
I think first and foremost, be thorough. Take a mm-hmm. thorough trauma history.
Mm-hmm.
Ask about all of these things.
Yeah. And start with the ACEs.
Yes.
It does not have to be a, all right, let's make a trauma timeline of all the terrible shit that's happened to you in your whole life.
In
that's
fact,
not what we're saying when we say take a thorough trauma history.
Yeah, no, that would be traumatizing
yes.
in and of itself.
That is re-traumatizing. Please don't do that.
Yes. ACEs are a great way to start.
Mm-hmm.
What are the things that you've experienced as a kid mm-hmm. that would lend themselves to maybe some of the things that you're experiencing,
right.
whether there's verbal violence in the house directed at you or someone else,
mm-hmm.
whether you had a caretaker that was mentally ill, whether mm-hmm. they use substances, you know, all of the things
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
of these, as we said, have such a drastic impact on the development of complex trauma.
Yep.
And the symptoms that you experience.
And knowing that those were there and they happened helps us conceptualize, okay, there might be more here.
Yeah. It might be complex trauma. It might be
mm-hmm.
something more nuanced than yeah. just all the diagnosis we just listed out.
Mm-hmm. It should automatically be a little yellow flag of, okay, I know that this is here. Let's, again, stay curious about how this impacted them.
Yeah. Yeah. And so also using complex trauma-informed frameworks. Mm. There are a wide variety of them.
Yep. Yep. Love Judith Herman's, Janina Fisher. Lots of folks love Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score book. I'm not getting into that.
Mixed feelings.
Mixed feelings. Mixed reviews here for me personally. But lots of people find it as a good resource. I don't find it particularly helpful for clients, for clinicians.
It's so...
It can be helpful, but for clients, I don't necessarily always know that it is I don't want to say beneficial because it can be beneficial, but it can also be re-traumatizing to read that book as a client.
Yeah, it's intense. It's an intense book.
It is. Yep. Yep. So then, of course, focusing on patterns across time, mm-hmm. especially the ones that are relational and developmental patterns.
If hallmarks of complex trauma. Mm-hmm. Of, are mm-hmm. these things being, is it happening in relationship, mm-hmm. whether that's to caretakers, to whoever, mm-hmm. to your environment? And is it happening across time, across your early development, across right. a period of development in general mm-hmm. of what's going on?
Yep. And right along with that, incorporating attachment history into assessment.
Yeah.
What were your relationships like as a kid?
Yeah.
What were your relationships like with parents? Yeah. Who was your primary caregiver? What yeah. was that like?
Yeah.
What is your relationship like with siblings if you have them?
Yeah. What relationships did you have modeled for you?
Mm-hmm.
This plays a huge part.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't know what secure relationships look like, if you had none growing up,
yeah,
it makes sense to yeah. why you would have an insecure attachment yeah. or have difficulty finding security in others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this itself, family history of who was in the household growing up, is a typical intake thing. But I think even more importantly is building on that and figuring out what the relationships were like, even if it's a very simple snippet. Again, little flags to be able to say, okay, let's keep yeah. remaining curious about this.
Yeah. Because even if it's snippets, those snippets add up over time to a clear picture, mm-hmm. a clearer picture.
Yeah.
Because it's never always super clear. It's complex trauma. It's, mm-hmm. again, it happens over a long period of time. The client's mm-hmm. recall might not be great. Mm-hmm. All of the things. But when you assess for these things, when you get the thorough history, when you explore like what those early attachments look like,
mm-hmm.
it makes it easier as a clinician to be able to feel confident that it's a trauma.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then how to best help by using some of the things that we talked about today, like explaining how the brain works. It can be super powerful. And along the lines of misdiagnosis, it happens often. I typically tell students and newer clinicians that even if a client comes to you with a list of diagnoses that they've had for a very long time, continue to be curious, and you're allowed to challenge those if you don't feel like they fit.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think that intentionality of, okay, if I don't feel like it fits, mm-hmm. like taking that extra step mm-hmm. to get curious, to mm-hmm. assess further.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes, you know, if it's on their file, if they came with it, whatever.
Yeah.
Maybe we don't take a second thought of like, okay, that's
yeah
what they have.
Right. There can be such a difference too between, okay, I had a whole thorough psychiatric or psychological evaluation that yeah. I spent multiple days with the psychologist fleshing this out.
Yeah.
That diagnosis probably looks a lot different than yes. I've collected all of these diagnoses from therapists along the way.
Yes. I think that's a good distinguishing point.
Or my general practitioner that diagnosed me with this thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That I think with most things requires some level of nuance.
Mm-hmm.
Be able to discern on your own. Use good clinical judgment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are lots of fun reasons why this is not an official diagnosis. And for sake of not making this episode 3 hours long, we will transfer this to a future episode. But again, relating back to healing is possible. There are lots of treatment options, and I do recognize that it is a privilege to have access to these things, and often it can be really difficult. But let's use these common approaches that we know work and start there.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't need, on the clinical side, to invest a lot of time and money and expensive trainings
mm-hmm.
to still be trauma-informed, to be able to utilize these approaches in a way that's not harmful to clients.
Right, right. Yeah. And now I'm feeling inspired to create an episode just about trauma-informed care and what that looks like.
Honestly, let's do it.
Let's do it.
Yeah, tune in, guys.
I think that's what's coming in next.
Yeah.
All right. Right. This was a lot. But if yeah. you are a person who related to some of the things that we talked about today, there is hope, there is healing, there is a light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, absolutely.
might be difficult.
But you can get there.
You can get there. Yeah. All right.
See you next time.
See ya.